This Marketplace podcast is supported by Invest Puerto Rico. What's next in innovation? That's not the right question. It's where. Puerto Rico, more than just a tropical paradise, it's innovation's paradise, where startups and global players coexist in a vast and vibrant ecosystem, where talent runs deep, highly skilled, and bilingual. Plus, the island offers the most competitive tax incentives in the U.S. If you believe your business can go anywhere, Puerto Rico is the place. Find out more at investpr.org/marketplace. Again, that address is investpr.org/marketplace.
Hey, Marketplace listeners, you know around here we like to think you're never too young to learn about the economy and financial basics. That's why we're bringing the Million Bazillion Live Tour to school to teach important lessons about budgeting, investing, saving, and more. It's all the fun of the podcast, but now live, immersive, and interactive. Special thanks to our tour partner, Greenlight, the debit card and money app for kids and teens. Learn more about Greenlight at greenlight.com/million. That is greenlight.com/million.
Support for this public radio podcast comes from Mellon Financial Corporation, helping financially successful individuals and families protect and maximize their assets through the practice of wealth management. Mellon.com. And by A.G. Edwards, caring for nest eggs for more than 120 years with a commitment to provide objective financial advice. Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, dedicated to a prudent approach to investing. Produced in association with the University of Southern California.
I don't know. What do you think? Should we just close down the stock market and all come back after Labor Day? Because the way things are going, all you have to do is say, boo, and investors start running for the doors. And it's not helping much that there is no end in sight. From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Reuters, the world's news and information source, working to make a difference every day. Before it's news, it's Reuters. And by Bank of America, believing that healthy communities and a healthy planet are essential to creating opportunities for everyone. Bank of America, Bank of Opportunity.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Good to have you here on this Thursday. It is the 16th of August today. And this day started like so many others have this month, a twitch in the financial markets leading to a steep slide in equities. The proximate cause this morning was Countrywide Financial. The country's biggest mortgage lender announced it's used up its entire line of outstanding credit, $11.5 billion from a whopping total of 40 lenders. Just another indication of how tough it's getting to find spare change out there. The official response to all the market unease so far has been, essentially, you're on your own. Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson told the Wall Street Journal there are no guarantees when market players take risks. And the head of the Federal Reserve Bank of St. Louis, William Poole, insists there's no need for the central bank to rush to the rescue with an emergency interest rate cut. Marketplace's senior business correspondent Bob Moon has more.
When a leading member of the Federal Reserve declares, in essence, that we'll cross that bridge when we come to it, it leaves Wall Street guessing. Interviewed by Bloomberg News, that's what William Poole suggested, that the Fed needs to wait and see if the market can sort out its own mess.
So let's let the market do its job, and we'll do our job when we get there.
But uncertainty is something investors can't stand. And at the University of Maryland, economist Peter Morici says that kind of talk only made things worse today.
Mr. Poole's comments may actually be destabilizing and panicking the markets.
Morici says the irony is the Fed has been taking action all along. It pumped another $17 billion of cheaper money into the credit market again today. Standard & Poor's chief economist David Weiss says Poole may insist there's no need for a rate cut, but the Fed's already delivered one.
Really, it is a de facto interest rate cut. You can see that by the fact that the federal funds rate has been around 5% for the last few days. But the markets aren't going to trade on that unless they have a feeling the Fed's going to keep it there. Not that this is just a temporary overshoot.
If the Fed insists on this kind of temporary fix, economist Peter Morici warns it could plunge the country into a recession.
They're looking across the lake and only jumping halfway, and in the process getting themselves all wet. It was correct a week ago to be pumping liquidity into the system. It is now apparent that far more is needed than that.
Morici says many Wall Street risk takers are already ruined, but now market panic is claiming innocent victims.
there is no reason why the Ford Motor Company or the corner grocery store should suffer to punish the inappropriate behavior of hedge fund managers and subprime lenders.
Morisi fears the market worries won't go away until the Fed takes decisive action. In Los Angeles, I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
The other notion that trickled through the markets today, aside from that thing Bob mentioned about the Fed having effectively cut rates already, was worries about something called commercial paper. And when we say paper here, we really mean money, short-term bonds that companies float to run their operations. Commercial paper is usually a pretty safe bet, but today's credit market is getting so risky that even that's getting harder to come by. John Lonsky is the chief economist at Moody's. Mr. Lonsky, welcome to the program.
Thank you.
Lay it out for me as simply as you can, how this works and what the risks are, whether perceived or real.
Companies can borrow money short-term either in the commercial paper market or for banks. Often, it is cheaper for companies of the highest credit quality to borrow in the commercial paper market.
That is, companies issuing their own bonds or IOUs to raise cash.
Exactly.
So these are important day-to-day sources of money that these guys need.
That's so true. It's an important means that major corporations use for the purpose of financing the buildup of inventories and other short-term expenditures. Lately, we find that creditors have become more cautious, and as a result, some companies have been forced out of the commercial paper market and instead have to rely on somewhat more expensive bank loans.
Well, make it all make sense for me then. What's going on in the stock market today? How is that influenced by the commercial paper drop? And what does it tell us about the future?
What we're stating is that total commercial paper outstanding declined by more than $90 billion.
Companies weren't issuing the debt, right?
Yeah, they were perhaps forced to turn elsewhere to secure short-term credit. Still, a drop of that magnitude is rare. In fact, last week's was a record-breaking plunge. Last time we had a contraction of commercial paper comparable in size to what is occurring today was in January 2001. And despite the Fed's best efforts, a recession would still get underway by March 2001.
Here's the $64 million question, Mr. Lonsky. How long is it going to take for either the market to correct itself or for some kind of more rational expectation of credit risk to take hold out there?
Well, one means of restoring confidence in commercial paper would be through a reduction in the federal funds rate.
Which is, of course, the rate that the Federal Reserve controls.
Correct, correct. As the Federal Reserve cuts the Fed funds rate, that reduces the cost of funds for financial institutions, and in turn, financial institutions tend to be more willing to take on more risk.
Rank commercial paper for me on your list of one of the things you look for trouble in the economy. I mean, you've been studying the American economy a long time. How important is this?
It's very important. It is a valuable barometer of the willingness of major sources of credit to make funds available to businesses. And if this condition persists long enough, the economy could stall or worse.
John Lonsky is the chief economist at Moody's Investor Service. Mr. Lonsky, thank you so much for your explanations and your definitions.
Thank you.
Oh, they're a gritty bunch on Wall Street. Traders white-knuckled their way back from 343 points down on the Dow to finish basically even. We'll have the details when we do the numbers. Donations to charity are pretty tough to come by, so one has to wonder why one of the world's biggest charitable organizations would start turning down aid from the U.S. government. CARE gets about $45 million a year from Washington, but the group has decided the strings attached to its food aid package are hurting developing countries. The decision puts a spotlight on growing criticism of federal funding for hunger relief, and it comes just as Congress is negotiating a five-year farm bill. Marketplace's John Dimsdale reports now from Washington.
Here's how the system works. The government buys surplus food from American farmers and ships it to charitable organizations in needy countries. The charities sell the food locally and raise about $180 million a year. But the biggest participant, CARE, says the food imports depress local prices. Helene Gale is the president of CARE.
In the long run, it wasn't in the best interest either of solving the problem of hunger or the most efficient way to raise cash to fund poverty-fighting programs.
Gale hopes foundations, corporations, and individuals will make up for the lost income. She wants the U.S. to consider other ways of helping, cash to buy locally produced farm products, for example. But Ellen Levinson with the Alliance for Food Aid says American food imports remain vital for many struggling countries.
I think it's absolutely appropriate in a country that's food deficit, and it depends on imports of a commodity to meet the food needs in the country.
The issue will be part of the Congressional Farm Bill debate next month. In Washington, I'm John Dimsdale for Marketplace.
If you've ever been up in the middle of the night with a sick infant or toddler, you know how tempting it is to want to give the kid some medicine just so everybody can get some sleep. If you haven't been there, trust me, it's tempting. But the Food and Drug Administration is warning parents not to give cough or cold medicines to children under 2 unless a doctor tells them to. The recommendation comes after a campaign by pediatricians who've treated overdoses of cold remedies you can find on the shelves of most drugstores. From the Marketplace Health Desk at WGBH in Boston, Helen Palmer has more.
When they grab that cough syrup for their sick kid, most parents probably don't read the label on the back. But Dan Frattarelli of the American Academy of Pediatrics says some active chemicals in these common medicines can be deadly.
Sudafedrin, for example, will be available as Sudafed, among other things. Diphenhydramine as Benadryl.
Frattarelli says an excess dose of pseudoephedrine can overstimulate the heart, and diphenhydramine is a sedative. But he stresses that at the proper dosage, for kids over 6, there's no danger. The makers of these medicines are represented by the Consumer Healthcare Products Association. Its president is Linda Sudam.
Parents have relied on these for many years. They rely on them because they work. They're safe if used as directed. Millions of parents have used them.
But pediatrician Dan Frattarelli says even though millions of parents have used them, that doesn't make them effective.
The data that we have on them shows that they don't work, at least in terms of controlling cough and cold symptoms.
An expert FDA panel will review these issues in October. In Boston, I'm Helen Palmer for Marketplace.
Take some bad housing numbers that came out this morning, combine them with crumbling credit markets, and how much more do you need to hear to start planning your escape to the beach? We've asked our commentators to suggest the best business beach books they know, titles that won't put you to sleep, just make you smarter, all while you dig your toes in the sand. Economist Marcellus Andrews picked one that really is all business.
Most folks want to keep risk in the rearview mirror as they make their vacation getaways. But I say take a thirst-quenching book about risk straight to the beach. Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism is a mind-opener. Economists William Baumol, Robert Litton, and Carl Schramm say that capitalism creates prosperity by replacing old technology with new technology, old skills with new skills. The idea that prosperity is born of destruction makes the first chunk of this book read like a horror story. If this book were a cold beer, it would be an assault-your-tongue lesson in what grown-up brew is all about, strong and deliciously bitter. To prosper, we've got to subsidize science, technology, and innovation. Go easy on taxing innovators, and yes, tax the rest of us instead. Maximize innovation. But here's the real thump between the eyes. Live with maximum insecurity, too. Support free trade to prime that competitive thirst. In short, push the nation to adopt an innovate-or-die mindset in the interest of economic survival. Now for the hard part. What the winners of the innovation game owe the losers is not the subject of this book. Are these guys crazy? No. They think that the only way America can stay rich is if Americans are always at the cutting edge. That's the best strategy for protection, the same way that sunscreen lets you enjoy the sun without getting a bad burn. Take deep drafts of Good Capitalism, Bad Capitalism this summer, and get real about risk before risk gets real with you.
Economist Marcellus Andrews lives in New York City. If you have a favorite beach book with a business flavor, share it with us. We're posting your recommendations on our website. It's marketplace.org. Coming up, for one woman in Cambodia, a job promises much more than just a paycheck.
It just automatically, she her value will improve in the family, in the society.
But first, let's do the numbers. The Dow dove more than 300 points out of the gate today. It rallied in mid-afternoon, trading to close down 0.1%, 15 points at 12,845. The Nasdaq slid 7 points, about 0.3%, to 2,451. The S&P 500 ended the day up 0.3%, 4 points at 1,411. Mortgage lender Countrywide Financial that we told you about skidded nearly 11% today on that loan news. Dell fell 2% after hours. The company announced it'll be restating earnings for 2003, 2004, 2005, 2006, and the first quarter of 2007. Bonds rallied sharply. The yield on the 10-year T-note plunged to 4.65%. And you're listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, managing money since 1937 with a focus on consistent results over the long term. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Coverage of Asia is supported by the Freeman Foundation. Want to hear something on Marketplace again? Help is as near as your home computer. To find audio archives of past programs and additional special features, just go to the internet and log on to our website. The information you need when you need it is only a few clicks away. Just head over to marketplace.org.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Friday. In Washington, humanitarian organization CARE discusses strategies to fight child labor. The University of Michigan reports results of its preliminary consumer sentiment survey for August. And too much of a good thing is wonderful. We have writer and stage and screen star Mae West to thank for that phrase, and so many others. She was born on August 17, 1893. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from American Public Media. I'm Kai Rizdal. You're probably not going to find the name Sean Carter or Curtis Jackson on any list of who's who in American business. But if you look them up under their stage names, you might have more luck. Jay-Z and 50 Cent are two of the better-known hip-hop artists out there. They're also on top of the new Forbes magazine list of hip-hop's cash kings. Leah Goldman's an associate editor at Forbes. Leah, good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
Now, I'm not the biggest hip-hop fan in the world, but even I know that these guys have been topping the charts for a while. Why is it so surprising that they're making all this money?
It's not necessarily a pioneering or a new thing, but what we found in recent years in particular is that the numbers keep growing in terms of their earnings as the music industry in general is in a slump and is suffering with the, you know, with the digital world. So in general, the music industry is in this weird crisis moment, and yet hip-hop artists seem to be doing incredibly well nonetheless. So we thought it was worth looking at and taking a look at how much these guys were making.
Well, how much are they making, and more importantly, why?
Well, in total, the 20 guys on our list, and they are all men, made $350 million. The top on the list is Jay-Z with $34 million. Why? Because they are smart enough to know that it's not just about selling albums. That'll keep you going for maybe 2-3 years tops. It's about building an empire and plowing those earnings into lasting businesses that will generate income long after the music stops selling.
How is it that these guys are so smart and, you know, country music stars and regular rockers aren't?
I have to say that in hip hop, from all the rappers we've spoken to and industry insiders, we've spoken to a lot of them, they all point to one person as being the pioneer of the business model, and that's Russell Simmons. Years and years ago, Russell Simmons came out, guy wasn't even much of a rapper, though he was involved in the rap scene, and said, you know what, you could sell music, that'll take you only so far. It's about selling a lifestyle. If you want to sell music, sell them a t-shirt, sell them a sneaker, sell them a drink, sell them a car. You can sell all those things with the music. It's not just about what you listen to, it's about who you are. And now, only now, are we seeing the pop stars recognize that and take that same business model to the next level. So you have women like Hillary Duff now. So now she's selling clothes and apparel and makeup and all this other stuff. Justin Timberlake just a couple weeks ago came out and announced he had his own imprint. This made big headlines, even though in hip-hop, having your own imprint is de rigueur. You're nobody unless you have an imprint.
Snoop Dogg You can see him on TV doing ads. I think it's with Lee Iacocca, right?
What does that tell you about corporatization of hip-hop?
What risk do the companies face, though? I mean, because let's be honest here. Hip-hoppers sometimes have, less than stellar reputations. They do some maybe not so smart things. Are the companies worried about being associated with that bad boy image?
They're about as worried about it as they are about being associated with a woman like Lindsay Lohan. Let's make no mistake about it. Hip hop, unfortunately, still has that reputation as being filled with thugs and criminals and whatnot, and perhaps deservedly so, given its roots. But it's way beyond that now. That's kind of the history of hip hop, but it's not the present reality. If you can point to Hollywood's excesses far more than you can to hip hop's. What are the risks? The same risks to branding a Kobe Bryant.
There's an element of hip-hop that sort of, it's all about street cred, right? At least in the beginning. And now, aren't these guys sort of selling out to the man, as it were?
That's a very interesting question, because authenticity at this point means you got a blue chip endorsement deal with HP. Being truly successful in this industry means you have your own imprint with Warner Music or Universal or what have you. Forget street cred. It's about how much money I'm making at the end of the year, and these guys know it.
Leah Goldman's an editor at Forbes. Leah, thanks a lot.
Thank you.
And we'll have a link to their listing of hip-hop's cash kings on our website. It's marketplace.org. Break down the global economy, and what do you have left? You get past enormous multinational corporations and smaller domestic companies, and you've got people getting up and going to work every day. Our monthly series, Working, takes us into the lives of individuals in the global economy. In the international silk trade, the big three are India, China, and Thailand. Today, we meet a woman who's trying to get Cambodia a piece of that action. The silk empire that she stitched together is the biggest employer in her province. Rachel Louise Snyder brings us the story of Chanta Nguyen.
Chanta Nguyen is a small woman, about 5 feet tall, but she's the economic epicenter of the remote Stung Treng province. So when there's talk about her, the effect can be whopping. Over breakfast at a sidewalk cafe one morning, she tells me about a merchant whose disturbing dream about her shook up the locals.
The coffee seller just ran to me. Oh, you're still alive. The gossip last night said you died. I said, why?
She doesn't put much stock in ghost gossip, but she's got dreams of her own, like starting a global business in a nearly illiterate region where trappings of modernity, like electricity, are scarce. At 45, Chanta is the picture of elegance in flowing skirts and dark shades, driving down a red, dusty road on her motorbike to work. Inside this creaky fence is the four-building silk compound called SWDC for Stung Treng Women's Development Center. She started this with her husband, Chan. This morning, Chanta rushes past two bright wooden workshops for spinners and weavers. Past a kindergarten she built for weavers' children. To a corner of the compound where three young women use bamboo paddles to stir raw silk in boiling dye.
So beautiful. This is my latest color.
She calls it
chili, chili.
Dramatic color is Chanta's genius. Each scarf has layers of subtle hues that change with the light. Chanta's brand of colorful scarves and pillows are called Mekong Blue. She sells them for $16 to $20, and they end up in fancy boutiques in Germany, France, Poland, Japan, and the U.S., where they go for $90 to $100 a piece. In Mekong Blue's first year, they made $2,500 with 5 looms. This year, on 33 looms, they'll make $60,000. While most businesses move toward mechanization, Chanta finds her operation works better with more hands and fewer machines. She once calculated that weavers walk over 9 miles in 11-foot intervals, just separating individual threads to prepare the looms. Other things are harder to calculate. How long does it take to make one average-sized scarf?
So first we spend 1 hour to wash the raw silk and 1 or 2 days to set up the warp. It's just half of it. They need another 7 days to finish. For that process, they spend another 5 days.
So how many, I've lost track, how many days are we up to?
11 to 12 days.
For a scarf?
No, to start to weave the scarf.
The grand total? 15 days. Unless...
You see the pattern, the flower pattern. That's another 9 days. But if they make a mistake, then they spend another week to remove everything.
This is obsessive-compulsive work. 60 full-time women earn $50 to $100 a month, where the country average is $25. But for the women who work here, it's not just about money. It's about status and education.
If we can help women to have her own income, just automatically, her value will improve in the family, in the society.
Her life and her business evolved out of tragedy. During the 1970s, the Khmer Rouge forced the population into farm labor in the countryside. They abolished money and personal freedom. Families were torn apart.
One of my brothers, he was taken away, and we don't know if he's still alive or he died. We just lost him.
This disastrous social experiment killed an estimated 1.5 million people. Chantal and her mother fled to Vietnam, where they spent 10 years. She spent 9 more years in a refugee camp on the Thai border. There, she got an education, first in English, then in women's empowerment, while working for Médecins Sans Frontières, or Doctors Without Borders. She met her husband Chan in the camp, and in 1993, they returned to Cambodia. At home, she meets her friends and family to cook a simple dinner. Here is where she transforms herself, from CEO to friend, mother, wife. She washes dishes in a metal bowl and enlists help from her son.
Oh, we need banana leaf, Johan. Can you help, Mama? Got it?
Shanta is trained to be something else. Not quite Western, not quite Khmer. She's comfortable in charge, at work or at home. But such confidence means she doesn't fit with village women. So foreigners on temporary contracts for various charities fill her friendship void. But the faces always change. The first time, she says,
we become very close friends, and then they left, and I feel sad again, but it just happened again and again. So every year, I have a new friend, and I lose some friends.
Today's menu is Vietnamese crepes. In the background, a radio plays Khmer music. Shanta tries to teach her two friends to fry paper-thin crepes.
Is it hot enough, Ali?
The first crepe crumbles.
That's not Khmer at all.
As Shanta tries to teach her foreign friends Khmer customs, she sometimes struggles with them herself. It's made it tougher for her husband. For the first 10 years of their marriage, Chan made the decisions, and she stayed quietly at home. But after a while, Shanta felt like she couldn't breathe. At first, he fought her change.
We compare ASEAN women with moonlight in the family. I mean, soft, cool, quiet. So I live 10 years, my first 10 years of marriage like that. I couldn't speak loudly and I couldn't laugh loudly. But after 10 years, I feel it's not me at all. So I start to fight with my husband. I want to be myself. Why I can't laugh? Why I can't speak loudly? So I told him, I am sunlight, not moonlight.
Rachel Louise Snyder lives and works in Cambodia. Her report was a co-production with Homelands Productions. We've got some pictures of Shanta Nguyen's weaving operation and other stories from our series, Working, on our website. It's marketplace.org.
Marketplace is supported by Putnam Investments, where a diversified approach to fixed income can strengthen your portfolio. Putnam Investments, a prudent approach to investing. Additional support from the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication.
This final note, we mentioned yesterday on the program how the Federal Trade Commission is trying to block Whole Foods from buying its organic rival, Wild Oats. The government says the deal would squelch competition and wind up with consumers paying more. Today, the judicial branch weighed in with a different view. A federal judge gave the deal a tentative thumbs up. We don't know exactly what his rationale was. The ruling was sealed because it contains corporate secrets, apparently. The government, that is, the executive branch this time, says it's going to appeal that ruling. And that is Marketplace from American Public Media. Today, the Dow closed down just 15 points, close to a tenth of 1%. 343 was the down limit on the Dow today. The NASDAQ dropped 7 points, 0.3%. The S&P 500 gained 4 points. That is 0.3% there as well. Our editors include John Buckley, Patty Hirsch, Margaret Koval, Karen Lowe, and Lisa Tucker. Next time on the program, high fashion finds new fans in the kennel set.
I don't dress myself the way I dress my dog. I dress him much better. He's my baby. Miwo, she's my baby.
I'm Kai Rizdahl. Hope you can join us for that tomorrow.
American Public Media.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.